Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 sometimes, on Tuesdays at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, part two of our chat to Bath activist Zaria Phillips. And from the Victims Unite website, an update on miscarriages of justice from Sabine McNeil, the starfighter. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show. What about the council generally? What do you make of them? Because it's not got a mayor like Bristol. It didn't vote for a mayor, did it?
No, it's a very interesting one, actually, at the moment. We have got some very good activists on the left, and I would say, you know, everybody from the Labour Party and the Greens in Bath are very good when it comes to community projects and supporting the communities. Vera Hobhouse, who's the new MP, she's been actually very supportive on the Fox Hill campaign. You know, I can't say what she does and what she doesn't do, but, you know, as far as we've seen so far, she's been very approachable, which is, we like that. But as I said to you earlier, my MP isn't Vera Hobhouse. I live in North East Somerset. It's still in Baines, and it's Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Oh, lucky you.
Thank you
so what's,
much.
I mean, actually, Rees-Mogg is seen as a sort of bit of a breath of fresh air by some people in the Tory party because of the,
does,
you know, the Theresa May and these various other people at the top. Michael Gove have been around for, it seems, forever. You know, Ian Duncan Smith, and he's a kind of new broom, maybe. Well, although, of course, he's from the old guard, you know, Etonian and all
he's
that.
He's no broom.
So what do you make of Rees-Mogg then?
I don't think
you're shaking your head.
I think a lot of things I'd like to say about him are not actually repeatable. I mean, unfortunately, you know, he has a lot of respect through the Conservative Party, and the his manor, I would say, is where I live, and all the little villages that have been always been Tory. He picks up on people who habitually vote Tory. I don't think he's a very good MP. He seems to be very funny when he goes on Have I Got News For You, and everybody thinks he's as jolly as Boris Johnson, but actually he's very scary on his views on women and women's rights, equalities. Yeah, I wouldn't say that I'm a big fan.
Are you a Brexiteer like him?
No, I'm not a Brexiteer. But you see, but even then, you know, he says he wants to leave Europe, and what he's trying to do now.
Let's be fair, the EU. Yeah, okay. Because everyone says Europe is the EU, which it isn't quite.
He's just going to leave anyway. But he's now promoting getting in cheap beef from America. So, you know, I don't really know. I can't really say what Jacob Rees-Mogg wants or thinks.
Anyway, we've talked a lot about what's going on right now in Bath.
Right.
Let's just talk a little bit about your past, because I know you're originally from London.
Yes.
And did you say you were a publican when we were chatting
before
we sat down?
Yeah, I used to work for Charrington's Brewery 4 years.
How did you get on with that?
Well, it was a very interesting time. It was after Thatcher had come in, and it was at a time where the 3 million unemployed was coming, but same a bit like is happening now. There was a lot of work in the hospitality sector, and it was when pubs were still community-based.
So where was your pub and what kind of pub was it?
Pubs mostly in London, but the last pub I had, I mean, I've had pubs in various parts in London, but the last one I had was in Wapping. In 1985, I moved to Wapping just as Rupert Murdoch moved in.
Oh, my God. So did you see any of the... Because there was absolute running battles, weren't there, apparently, between the print workers and the police in Wapping.
It was horrendous. As a supporter of the miners the previous year, and still a supporter of the Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign, I think what had happened is that Thatcher's government, and it is evident, we've got the evidence, that they learnt at the... They learnt at Orgreave, and then they came to Wapping.
So this was the, let's just, you know, scroll back 20. To there. This is the miners' strike. Mm-hmm. It was absolute warfare up in, mostly up in Yorkshire, Nottinghamshire, places like that, Lancashire. It was also, I would imagine, probably Kent, but mostly up north.
Yeah.
So the miners were on strike, which, I mean, it just seems to me that they're maybe shooting themselves in the foot by actually helping to close down the pits if they just won't turn up to work for whatever, 6 months or a year.
No, it was not quite like that. I mean, it is all about people, about pay, working conditions. You know, essentially, people needed to have hope, need a job so you could provide and you could live, and you know, that's what they were. You know, Thatcher's
nowadays,
they were taking. They wanted to close them down for no reason.
Well, nowadays they say coal's terrible, don't they?
Yes, that argument is now 33 years later, and I understand that argument, but at the time. You know, you're taking people's livelihoods
away. Well, people say that Thatcher was well ahead of her time. You know, she was closing down the mines when before people even knew that coal was a terrible thing.
I don't think she was doing it on the thought that it was bad for the environment. I don't ever believe her saying that.
I can remember actually going to Big Pit, which is over in South Wales, which is a sort of museum based. I mean, I think it's mostly former miners that will sort of take you around there. It's well worth a visit if people haven't been out there. But I spoke to two miners, one of whom said it was great that they closed down the pits because it was a horrible job. Mm-hmm. And the other guy said it was the biggest tragedy ever because they and their forefathers had struggled for generations to get decent conditions down the mines and safe conditions down the mines. They'd achieved it in the 60s and 70s. Yeah. And then in the 80s, the whole lot was closed down and they moved the production of coal out of the country to countries where there were no regulations or there were no unions. So what was your view on, you know, the rights and wrongs of the strike?
Well, I think, again, you know, you go back to where people's livelihoods are. When you grow up and you know what you know and you do the job you're good at, you're a skilled, however it works, you're skilled at doing the job you're doing, you take that out of the equation, what are they going to do? You know, I mean, this is an argument a friend's father said to me, well, they could have gone and get another job. I said, yeah, okay, 11,000 miners from Orgreave, because they've all got a job in Woolworths in Sheffield. You know, they were skilled workers. Somebody who worked in Woolworths couldn't have gone and dug a mine, but they certainly were thinking that's what they should be doing the other way around. You know, and then, of course, it's left whole swathes of communities that haven't had any investment since. There are no jobs. You know, the issues around mental health, drugs, alcohol, the depression of communities.
Yeah, you know? You go up to some of these places like Doncaster, etc., and Sheffield up north, you'll find there's a great big city there that doesn't really seem to have any purpose anymore.
No.
Which is, you know, tragic, really. You've got
very little industry
left.
Well, quite, but you take away an industry, but it's not just the industry. It's the pubs, the clubs, the transport, the cleaners. The biggest knock-on effect is just the whole community finding itself not able to survive.
So you have running battles with the miners trying to picket the pits and various characters trying to ship the coal out or move the coal into the power stations, this sort of thing. Running battles with the police between the miners, massive pickets of miners and the police. And then after that sort of paramilitary style of policing, they then came down to around your neck of the woods in Wapping. What did you see down in Wapping then?
Well, they did. Well, you know, I wasn't directly on the picket line, but I used to see people. I knew what had happened. And you live the experience by talking to people. And the fact that we've got a lot of evidence to show exactly what was going on, like with Orgreave, it was, you know, the bullying tactics of the government and the media that was, you know, again, it was making it out what it wasn't, you know, the Murdoch media and the way that it had to go at the Orgreave and what was happening there and the way that they made it into something else it wasn't. You know, they used different footage, they turned a lot of the public against them. And the same thing happened at Wapping. On the strength of Orgreave, they came up to Wapping just thinking, right, well, we can beat the print unions, because the things that Thatcher didn't like were the unions, and that's where they were going. It wasn't even about the people. It was about, we're not going to let you do what you know, give yourselves a good job, a pay, conditions, a community. What they did is they broke the communities. Orgreave, Wapping, then we went to Battle of the Beanfield. They took the community out of that group, and that's what they were doing very successfully.
So what made you leave Wapping, or what's, you know, because that was a pub?
Yeah, I had my son. Yeah,
and then you came up this part of the world did you?
Yeah, I did 20 years ago. I moved to Bath, which was a good thing for me and my son. And, you know, I had friends and family here, so.
Because people think of Bath, I think, I mean, I certainly do, as a little bit austere, maybe austerity, I don't want to get that too confused, but it's slightly upmarket, should we say, a bit posh, not very much in the way of lefty activism going on in Bath. Now, you've talked about Unite Communities, and you've talked about Bath Against the Cuts. Anything else really going on the ground in Bath?
Well, Bath 20 years ago is very different to what it is now, and I had a council house, you know. You know, the communities that we worked in, I worked in education, you know, and the sort of things that we were very active in are still, you know, the issues that we're still fighting in Bath. Is it could be anything from the pollution of the London Road, or whether there should be another road, or whatever it is. And now, of course, later on, the knocking down of the estates. But unfortunately, going back to Thatcher, they sold off all the council houses. So, you know, again, communities that are in Bath, they are still there. And, you know, we see them, we talk to them. And again, with Unite Community, we go out, we talk to people. And alongside the Bath Against Cuts, you know, we go out and train people up if they've been out of work for a while or want to revisit work being part of a union. So again, Bath there's a lot going on.
What's the main industry? Is there any industry left much in Bath now?
Bath, hospitality, and it's
tourism
and hospitality, and the jobs in hospitality. And now we're finding that business owners are shipping their staff in because they can't afford to live in Bath. You know, it's an issue.
What, shipping them from where?
From Trowbridge.
Oh, right. So are they commuting up to Bath?
Yeah, people are having to commute to go to work. But quite often there was an issue a couple of months back that we have found out about, is that one of the business owners was, you know, putting on a minibus to bring his staff in.
But the city centre seems to have had a bit of a revamp, doesn't it, recently?
Yes.
Looking
for the
better?
Tourists, no. For the tourists, and there's a lovely casino that's not going to be used by the locals. A couple of new hotels that won't be used by locals. Part of the college where I used to work, it sold off one of its buildings. They've sold off a lot of the staff that work there as well, but they've sold off one of the buildings which is going to be turned into a hotel. So yeah, we've got the hospitality going on in Bath, but it's bleeding Bath dry.
Also, it'd be nice to finish with some contacts for Unite Community and Bath Against the Cuts. So if people want to follow what you're up to, mm-hmm. How do they do that, Zaria?
Right, well, if you're on Facebook, then of course you can find Bath Against Cuts with Unite Community. If you look up the Bristol Area Unite Community branch, that's on a Facebook page. Contact any, if you put that into a website, even if you haven't got Facebook and you're not confident in using it, just put those into the search engine and you'll find contact details, mostly for me. If you live in Bristol, pop into the Unite building, which is Tony Benn House on Victoria Street. We meet there once a month on a Thursday, first Thursday of the month. You know, you can pop in, or you can just pop in there and they'll give you our details.
Is that the early evening or something?
No, that's 11 o'clock. 11 o'clock on a Thursday.
Okay.
Not in December, but normally we meet there. Yeah.
So and with the Bath Against the Cuts, don't you find that all these lefties are always having a go at each other, like the People's Front of Judea and the Judea People's Front?
No, we don't. The anti-cuts are not like that at all. We're certainly not politically aligned to anybody. And we welcome everybody and everybody's views and thoughts. But what we like to make sure is that we're all heard and not one group dominates another, you know. So, and we're very good at that. Same with Unite Community. You know, I've got every political party in my branch.
Including the Conservatives?
No, sorry, I forgot them. They're not, they didn't, they don't seem to want to come out and play.
Jacob not come along to those
meetings?
Yeah,
he hasn't quite signed up to it yet, but no, I don't, you know, but we are. We cover everybody. We don't leave anybody behind.
Zaria Phillips, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined now by Sabine McNeil from, well, from many things, but one of them is a website called victims-unite.net. Hi, Sabine, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Good to hear you again.
Now, you've just flown in to the UK again, haven't you? You jet about quite a bit. Where from this time?
Well, no, actually, this is not quite true, Tony. After I went into exile for 6 months, the police always thought that I would run away again, even though London has been my home since 1981. And they actually prevent me from leaving the UK now because they think I might run away again. But you see, at the time I left because of the threat of imprisonment by a secret family court. Now, I consider that highly criminal, that such a thing could and should happen. And I knew from Harriet Harman, who had quoted in 2006 in Parliament already, that 200 parents get regularly imprisoned a year. So I knew it was real when I got that order, but however fake it was. But that's what the mother of the children and I, whom I had helped as a McKinsey friend, were served with. She has never come back to the UK.
So you need to just explain, what is a McKinsey friend? If you're playing that role in court, why are you doing that and what is it?
Good question. McKinsey friends have had legal status in the UK ever since there was a case, McKinsey versus McKinsey, where it was a divorce case and one in the 70s. And one of the partners ran out of money and a barrister from Australia had flowed in to help. Then they fought for the right to act as a McKinsey friend. And they succeeded. So we've been helping anybody and everybody who came our way. And we are a loose network all over the country, men and women who all have been victimized in one way or another and learned, in other words, through the painful experience of having been defrauded by solicitors, by other public institutions, in courts, by secret family courts. We visited people in prison after they were criminalized, after the children had been taken. And I started actually my first action by listening to the worst fraudulent bankruptcies that people knew. And I took them to the then Minister of Justice, Kenneth Clark. And so one case led to another. And then at the time, I organized meetings at the House of Lords, and Lord Sudley had said, we must group cases to change the law. And that's how Victims Unite was born, eventually, because I was then still on publishing a few other websites. But I began to write case summaries for victims because I felt so helpless and so powerless. What else could I do for them?
Okay, and so with Victims Unite, did you find that it was fairly easy to just write your thoughts and your challenges to the legal system up on the blog, or was there attempts to shut that down too?
Good question, Tony. I remember I happened to have been in Germany when I cared for my mum, when I got a phone call from a barrister who was representing a woman who acted as McKinsey friend and ended up in Holloway for 10 days. And she had been a serious financial victim, and then herself and her sister and a whole bunch of other people. And then she had helped a mother whose daughter was taken away from her and given to the abusive father, which is one of the terrible patterns we've observed. And the McKinsey friend's barrister asked me to take down all of the posts relating to that woman. So that was the first experience when I didn't have to close the blog down, but I had to delete all of the posts. My blog had been closed down by WordPress.com after Swansea Council had interfered. That was because I had published photos that I had received from the mother whose boy was taken from her, and she had taken the photos of the mother's milk that she had pressed and gathered in little bottles and kept in the fridge, but the social services didn't collect it because the little boy was allergic to industrial milk.
Okay, so give us just a bit of a roundup of some of the things that have been coming up recently. I know, you know, you were saying, for example, that it's have you been in Ireland? Because I know that I would have thought that if there have been attempts to stop you leaving the UK, you can, I mean, I'm just thinking about all these Brexit talks we've been having recently, that surely you can just go to Northern Ireland, then you can just very easily cross out of the UK into Southern Ireland, and you're suddenly you're in a different jurisdiction and the British courts don't have any power over you.
That's what Norman Scarth did. He is our veteran Mackenzie friend and veteran victim survivor, as I always call them, turned starfighters, turned Mackenzie friends, turned online activists. Norman was a very, very badly victimized as well, and was in fact not only imprisoned but also incarcerated. Well, Norman Scarth is the most remarkable war hero. He was, as a very young man, on the Scharnhorst, and for that, of course, molded him for life.
What is the Scharnhorst? A battleship or something?
It was a big battleship which was sunk. And
German? It sounds German.
Yes, yes. And so he was, in theory, a war hero.
In the Second World War?
Yes, okay. Because he helped sink it. But
hang on, he was on the ship and he also helped to sink it?
Yeah.
What was he, a saboteur?
Well, no, wait a minute. No, sorry, he was on the British ship and so he helped to sink it.
Oh, right. So he was on the Royal Navy ship that sank the sun. Okay.
Yeah, but he just really suffered from that experience and you know, just so many young lives wasted, and then the worst thing is he becomes an enemy of the state, so he has to flee to Ireland, because
how did that happen? He's in the Royal Navy one minute, and he suddenly becomes an enemy of the state. Why?
Well, suddenly, when he was over and above 70, that was the most ironic situation. But I quite honestly, I don't remember the details, but I do remember that I petitioned to get him out of prison, and it was one of my early online petitions, and there were lots of people who helped their way, but I always just did it by online activity and exposure and support, if you like. And I also remember that John Hemming spoke to him, because John Hemming was also was the former Lib Dem MP who pointed to the secret prisoners of the Court of Protection and the Family Court. Now, Norman wasn't really involved with that, but he also suffered from a restraining order, and that's what Maurice and I have in common as well. You remember Maurice Kirk, whom you have had on your show a number of times. He is now supposed to be sentenced because a jury found him guilty of having supposedly violated a restraining order. I mean, Tony, you can't make it up. There's a psychiatrist who wasn't medically qualified to make a false diagnosis, but I had to take all of the reference to this, to that psychiatrist down from Maurice's website so that he doesn't violate that restraining order. But because he's been found guilty, and because even though the diagnosis is blatantly wrong, he can be go down to prison on the 14th. It's the next sentencing hearing.
Okay, so this whole idea of the restraining order, this seems to be quite something which is being one of the latest tactics, really, used by the judiciary to silence people who are trying, like you are, to get miscarriages of justice put right. So what is a restraining order? And just give me some examples of how violating one of these can, you know, either get you arrested, put you in jail, or, you know, so where do these restraining orders come from? Who imposes them?
Very good question, Tony, as always. Maurice got his restraining order.
So this is Maurice Kirk, and he's the flying vet, isn't he? He's been in and out of jail for various things. But, I mean, basically, we've had him on this programme. It certainly seems as if he was being victimised by South Wales police because of a basically connection where he had evicted somebody who was well connected with South Wales police and also connected with drug dealing. So, and then he seemed to upset the police, even though he was effectively doing what they should have been doing, which was making life difficult for a drug dealer. So anyway, that's Maurice. And what happened with his restraining order? How did he get one?
Good point. Well, you see, this is the terrible thing. Instead of the criminal, i.e. the guy who wrote the false diagnosis being tried, Maurice was given a restraining order, supposedly given. He even keeps questioning that. He never got it served. He found out by chance that somebody, i.e. a judge, supposedly, often, of course, all of such orders are written by the barristers, and then the judge just signs them, and he was supposed... These restraining orders are written in the spirit of the Protection from Harassment Act, and they are supposed to protect a person from harassment. Well, in this case, it's this doctor who was supposed to be protected from harassment, and Maurice had exposed this doctor on his website, and so to prove that we want to comply to this restraining order, I had to take all of the Maurice's references off his website. Now, the jury found him guilty of having violated this restraining order, but surely and only because this case is just far too complex for any jury to think it through and to follow properly. And of course, the jury is always likely to believe police and the authorities, and it can't possibly be wrong that they could be wrong and Maurice could be right. So he was found guilty, and now what hangs over him is a so-called sentencing hearing, i.e. whether he's going to get so many years or months of prison. And meanwhile, they are trying to get this or that or the other done, and like getting another psychiatric assessment and not finding a psychiatrist.
Well, they're basically saying that Maurice is mad.
That's what Norman Scarth calls the Gulag card. If they don't manage to get you into prison, then they try to get you into a mental hospital. And both Norman and Maurice have suffered that. Already, Maurice spent 3 months, and I can't remember how many months Norman spent, in one of those mental hospitals. And we know of a mother whose 2 children were taken, whose husband seems to have been killed, and she was put into Ashworth, this high security mental hospital. Well, absolutely terrible. And Len Lawrence is also the person who knows about that. And then there's a psychologist, Dr. Rainer Kurz, who also knows about that. And how Dr. Kurz calls it, psychiatry is the Kalashnikov of the 21st century. And Len, who is the pilot who was poisoned by organic...
Hang on, this is a bit confusing, because Maurice is the flying vet. Are you telling me we've got another pilot who's also a victim of these restraining orders?
Len hasn't been a victim of a restraining order. The victims of restraining orders... actually, I'm not 100% sure with Norman, but Norman goes on about the badly written Protection from Harassment Act, and the fact that restraining orders can be dished out, as in my case, even though the case collapsed of the other side, they still handed down this restraining order. And that's why Norman says the whole act is badly written. I see that these restraining orders are made, they have become a tool to get us behind bars in a sort of small in an easier way, even though, I mean, as in my case, I was acquitted, as in Maurice's case, even though the restraining order hadn't been served or then was subsequently supposedly varied. But all of this just gets ignored. In other words, there is not clean, clear, black and white justice, you know, guilty versus, or certainly not innocent until proven guilty. This is what I object so much. I've been treated as a criminal suspect. And it is just, I mean, so inhuman and ridiculous. Well, anyway, so the restraining order is one issue which is a consequence of the application of the Protection from Harassment Act. And the critical thing is that instead of the criminals being put on trial, we, the whistleblowers, become the criminal suspects. And well, we are prevented from supposedly harassing the criminals, what we do by exposing them online, supposedly.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, basically with something like a law of harassment, you would have thought that, you know, this is something which could be used, you know, if the law is not equitable, in other words, that the rich have got much more access to it than the poor, that rich people are simply going to use the law to try and stop anybody giving them any sort of, I mean, even speaking ill of them, you know, speaking badly about the rich and powerful. And it could be used as a way of just oppressing the rich, oppressing the poor.
Well, you are going much further than I would have gone, Tony, in my interpretation of this law. But that's effectively exactly what's happening. That's precisely true. Now, I happen to be on legal aid because I had to live off charity. You know, I had absolutely zero income for 2.5 years. So I, my solicitor fortunately is used to that. But whether that guarantees justice for me is another ballgame altogether. And I just keep saying, I mean, I want to protest my innocence, but I can't even do that. Because now, since I was charged, one of my bail conditions is, first of all, I mustn't leave the UK. Secondly, I mustn't send anything to anybody. So, you know, so now my solicitor has to vary the bail conditions before anything can, well, before, unless I give the other side, i.e. the police, a reason for arresting me.
With Norman and yourself, just give us an idea of what sort of effect this has on people like you, because, you know, you're going in there, you're helping out people who are desperately, you know, they're almost in a way kind of sinking in the mud of the judicial system, where they're finding, you're seeing clearly before your eyes a miscarriage of justice going on. You're wading in order to try and help someone, and you find that you yourself then start sinking too.
Yes. And I mean, I was going to say, fortunately, I'm not alone. Brian Peed is somebody else who, I mean, he acted as a Mackenzie friend for somebody, and then he was charged with parading as a barrister, which is perfectly non-true. I've just gotten an email from a judge in Reading that I should think about the implications if I want to act as a Mackenzie friend for a friend who was found not to have capacity to lead his own litigation. I mean, you can't make it up, but all I call it the people processing industry, or other people have before me, like Maurice Kirk and Patrick Cullinan. I've talked about the public gravy train. I mean, it is.
In what way is it a gravy train, though?
Well, it's public. You see, legal aid or money. It's public money that is provided by the system for the system on the back of victims who get processed.
But hang on, because there's been a big cuts in legal aid, haven't there? Ken Clark in 2011, 2012 cut back legal aid massively, and you know, it seems to me, certainly by my reading of it, that now the law is something which is much easier for the rich to access than the poor.
Well, Maurice is certainly not on legal aid. I don't know how many tens of thousands he's paid on buying the transcripts of his hearings. I'm not sure whether Norman ever paid for any of his things.
Yeah, also, another reason that I know people like you have difficulty even just being a Mackenzie friend or helping out somebody in a miscarriage of justice is the bail conditions. What sort of bail conditions get set nowadays?
I can't tell you. I can only tell you from the cases that I'm familiar with. And they are just so stringent and so limiting that they are basically traps. Because without thinking, I'd sent an email, of course, you know, and blind copied my solicitor, and I said, "Did you realize that you were breaking your bail conditions?" I said, "Of course not." And a friend of mine, Maurice, said that the same thing happened to him. Not thinking, you just don't. I mean, you try to process.
Well, hang on, that's your fault. I mean, if you're signing up to bail conditions and you're saying, "No, I won't communicate with X, Y, and Z, and I won't say X, Y, and Z," and then you break those, then surely, you know, someone is bound to find out and come down on you.
Well, excuse me, I didn't sign up to these bail conditions. I was served them, and my solicitor took the piece of paper away, and it took a while for them to scan them and send them to me, and then for me to process a very badly laid out piece of paper with six charges of one type and four charges of another, and then oodles of bail conditions. I mean, it takes a bit of a shock to process. It's a bit of a shock to process that rationally and to take it in. I mean, it's about my way of process. Therapy is my writing, Tony. I need to write to express my. I don't have lots of people to talk to who would understand the depth and of the depravity.
I totally understand, actually. It's about getting it out of your system, isn't it? Articulating how you're feeling.
Yes.
And making sense of what sometimes must be maddening. I mean, the family courts, for example, anyone who's never dealt with the family courts, have you got any advice for them?
Oh, gosh. What do I advise people to? I mean,
even the people who are in charge at a national level of the family courts admit that there are quite serious flaws with the way it operates, and usually due to secrecy, trying to protect the identity of children, for example.
Well, that's the pretext for removing them, Tony. 1,000 children a month are removed, and it looks as if it's only 150 of the 350 councils who are involved in doing that. But that's the cover. And that's the same thing that happens with the Court of Protection. That's what Len Lawrence found out. Parents are found not to have capacity, and so that they can take their children. And like the elderly people who don't have capacity, they take their houses so that that solicitors sell them behind their backs. That's what happened to Len Lawrence, whose brain was damaged by organophosphates, as he was a commercial pilot flying very highfalutin people around.
Okay, tell us a bit about Len's case then. That sounds interesting. So these organophosphates are effectively, they're used as pesticides and things like that, aren't they? So what happened to Len?
Yes, there are lots of victims who suffered from sheep dipping, for example. But Len was one of the many pilots who got poisoned by these fumes that are containing organophosphates in aeroplanes. And so when he was suffering from his brain injuries, which were also, he also then got certified not to have capacity to lead his own litigation. So then the official solicitor comes in and takes over and leads, does everything on your behalf, and in his case they sold his house behind his back so that his wife could benefit but he not. And that's how he found out about the badness of the Court of Protection. And the Court of Protection had been pointed out to me by a woman who lives in Canada, whose aunt left her something and she never could get it because the official solicitor stepped in and stole. And you see, this is this abuse of power and position. That's the white collar criminality that I've been observing over all these years.
Okay, you say also that you think that we need McKinsey A teams. Now it almost seems like you're inviting people to come in to suffer like you have. So how are you going to actually convince anyone to do that, Sabine?
I'm not going to convince anybody. I mean, I can't do that. But there are so many victims around. I mean, I get enough comments on the Victims Unite site. I get enough emails. I just am worn out. I'm focusing on my software, and I can't. And because I've been gagged so badly by the restraining order that I can't even talk about my own case, let alone the underlying case that caused me to be in my position.
Oh no! I mean, is there anything you can tell us about your case at all?
Well, the fact that I've been gagged as a whistleblower, why can I not say so? I'm not making any allegation that I'm forbidden to say. I'm just saying that now I'm gagged as a whistleblower, just like all of the parents who are gagged, who, once the children have been taken, they mustn't talk about the fact that their children have been taken. These are the gagging orders. These are the restraining orders. There are also other civil restraint orders, but I can't remember exactly, but I looked it up. They're slightly different. But to call them gagging orders is more appropriate. And it is just absolutely horrendous that and how judges and barristers and courts are abusing their position and power rather than delivering justice. And not only to victims, but also to McKinsey friends. And yes. And so, I mean, when I say I want, you know, following the model of the A teams, I want McKay teams now. It just so happens that there are groups and pockets of people who act together in certain ad hoc, like flash mobs, ad hoc teams, as and when required. But we are all gray-haired and we are all exhausted and we all seem to get hold of the worst of all possible cases. That's just the way it's been, and it's a sad, sad observation to have to make.
Okay, would you like to round up by trying to inspire us? Because the trouble is, a lot of this, you seem to be banging your head against a brick wall quite a lot of the time, but I'm sure from time to time there are moments where you think it is all worthwhile.
Well, my mum at some critical moment in my life said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I have learned to look at the worst that can happen and thus face my fears. I think a lot has to do with turning fear into courage. And I've certainly learned how my own thoughts are creating my own fears more than anything. Except my body just seems to react to any noise. I mean, the fact that the police showed up at 1 o'clock in the morning and handcuffed me, that was just too much. I mean, my body won't forget that. So to be positive, I encourage everybody to keep fighting and to not to hang in there. You want to die knowing and being able to look into the mirror every day, knowing that you've tried your best. And it's us like-minded people, you know, the more experience we have and we can share thanks to the internet, the more us types of people do come together and they all do all sorts of things different ways, differently. For example, there's an extraordinary website that only came my way not so long ago, which is called bentlawyersandcops.com. It isn't maintained anymore, but it's an absolutely brilliant collection of stories, in a way much more explicit than Victims Unite, because they had a team of three, I think, who worked on it together, and they had one detailed story after another on their website, and they also name and shame the people involved. I have never been so much into the name and shame game, but there is a website, Solicitors from Hell, where I consider taking one company to because of what I've just seen recently in another fabulous woman, she says the Law Society needs to be taken down because they have closed down 15,000 firms when they shouldn't have done so. And, you know, I can only be grateful to the internet that helps these things to come out.
Okay, Sabine McNeil from the website victims-unite.net. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for asking wonderful questions, Tony.
That's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You could subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Zaria Phillips, Bath-based activist, and from Victims Unite website, Sabine McNeil. Also the studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
lines drawn between